By World Series time of 1950, this was the year the Philadelphia Whiz Kids dropped four straight, you will remember, Andy was having no more trouble from the sisters. Stamos and Hadley had passed the word. If Andy Dufresne came to either of them, or any of the other screws that formed a part of their coterie and showed so much as a single drop of blood in his underpants, every sister in Shawshank would go to bed that night with a headache. They didn't fight it. As I've pointed out, there was always an 18-year-old car thief, or a fire bug, or some guy who'd gotten his kicks handling little children. After the day on the plate shop roof, Andy went his way, and the sisters went theirs. He was working in the library then, under a tough old con named Brooks Hatlin. Hatlin had gotten the job back in the late 20s because he had a college education. Brooksy's degree was in animal husbandry, true enough, but college educations in institutes of lower learning like the Shank are so rare that it's a case of beggars not being able to be choosers. In 1952, Brooksy, who had killed his wife and daughter after losing his streak at poker back when Coolidge was president, was paroled. As usual, the state, in all its wisdom, had let him go long after any chance he might have had to become a useful part of society was gone. He was 68 and arthritic when he tottered out of the main gate in his Polish suit and his French shoes, his parole papers in one hand and a Greyhound bus ticket in the other. He was crying when he left. Shawshank was his world. What lay beyond its walls was as terrible to Brooks as the western seas had been to superstitious 15th-century sailors. In prison, Brooksy had been a person of some importance. He was a librarian, an educated man. If he went to the Kittery Library and asked for a job, they wouldn't even give him a library card. I heard he died in a home for indigent old folks up Freeport Way in 1953, and at that he lasted about 6 months longer than I thought he would. Yeah, I guess the state got its own back on Brooksy, all right. They trained him to like it inside the shithouse, and then they threw him out. Andy succeeded to Brooksy's job, and he was librarian for 23 years. He used the same force of will I'd seen him use on Byron Hadley to get what he wanted for the library, and I gradually saw him turn one small room, which still smelled of turpentine because it had been a paint closet until 1922 and had never been properly aired, lined with Reader's Digest, condensed books, and National Geographics, into the best prison library in New England. He did it a step at a time. He put a suggestion box by the door and patiently weeded out such attempts at humor as "More Fook Books, Please," and "Escape in 10 Easy Lesions." He got hold of the things the prisoners seemed serious about. He wrote to the major book clubs in New York and got two of them, the Literary Guild and the Book of the Month Club, to send editions of all their major selections to us at a special cheap rate. He discovered a hunger for information on such small hobbies as soap carving, woodworking, sleight of hand, and card solitaire. He got all the books he could on such subjects, and those two jailhouse staples, Earl Stanley Gardner and Louis L'Amour. Cons never seemed to get enough of the courtroom or the open range. And yes, he did keep a box of fairly spicy paperbacks under the checkout desk, loaning them out carefully and making sure they always got back. Even so, each new acquisition of that type was quickly read to tatters. He began to write to the State Senate in Augusta in 1954. Stamos was warden by then, and he used to pretend Andy was some sort of mascot. He was always in the library, shooting the bull with Andy, and sometimes he'd even throw a paternal arm around Andy's shoulders or give him a goose. He didn't fool anybody. Andy Dufresne was no one's mascot. He told Andy that maybe he'd been a banker on the outside, but that part of his life was receding rapidly into his past, and he'd better get a hold on the facts of prison life. As far as that bunch of jumped-up Republican Rotarians in Augusta was concerned, there were only three viable expenditures of the taxpayers' money in the field of prisons and corrections. Number one was more walls, number two was more bars, and number three was more guards. As far as the State Senate was concerned, Stamos explained, the folks in Thomaston and Shawshank and Pittsfield and South Portland were the scum of the earth. They were there to do hard time, and by God and sonny Jesus, it was hard time they were going to do. And if there were a few weevils in the bread, wasn't that just too fucking bad? Andy smiled his small, composed smile and asked Stamos what would happen to a block of concrete if a drop of water fell on it once every year for a million years. Stamos laughed and clapped Andy on the back. "You got no million years, old horse, but if you did, I believe you'd do it with that same little grin on your face. You go on and write your letters. I'll even mail them for you if you pay for the stamps." Which Andy did. And he had the last laugh, although Stamos and Handley weren't around to see it. Andy's request for library funds were routinely turned down until 1960, when he received a check for $200. The Senate probably appropriated it in hopes that he would shut up and go away. Vain hope. Andy felt that he had finally gotten one foot in the door, and he simply redoubled his efforts. 2 letters a week instead of one. In 1962, he got $400, and for the rest of the decade, the library received $700 a year, like clockwork. By 1971, that had risen to an even thousand. Not much, stacked up against what your average small-town library receives, I guess, but $1,000 can buy a lot of recycled Perry Mason stories and Jake Logan westerns. By the time Andy left, you could go into the library, expanded from its original paint locker to 3 rooms, and find just about anything you'd want. And if you couldn't find it, chances were good that Andy could get it for you. Now, you're asking yourself if all this came about just because Andy told Byron Hadley how to save the taxes on his windfall inheritance. The answer is yes and no. You can probably figure out what happened for yourself. Word got around that Shawshank was housing its very own pet financial wizard. In the late spring and the summer of 1950, Andy set up 2 trust funds for guards who wanted to assure a college education for their kids. He advised a couple of others who wanted to take small flyers in common stock, and they did pretty damn well, as things turned out. One of them did so well he was able to take an early retirement 2 years later. And I'll be damned if he didn't advise the warden himself, old Lemon Lips George Dunahy, on how to go about setting up a tax shelter for himself. That was just before Dunahy got the bum's rush, and I believe he must have been dreaming about all the millions his book was going to make him. By April of 1951, Andy was doing the tax returns for half the screws at Shawshank, and by 1952 he was doing almost all of them. He was paid in what may be a prison's most valuable coin, simple goodwill. Later on, after Greg Stamos took over the warden's office, Andy became even more important. But if I tried to tell you the specifics of just how, I'd be guessing. There are some things I know about and others I can only guess at. I know that there were some prisoners who received all sorts of special considerations, radios in their cells, extraordinary visiting privileges, things like that. And there were people on the outside who were paying for them to have those privileges. Such people are known as angels by the prisoners. All at once some fellow would be excused from working in the plate shop on Saturday forenoons, and you'd know that fellow had an angel out there who'd coughed up a chunk of dough to make sure it happened. The way it usually works is that the angel will pay the bribe to some middle-level screw, and the screw will spread the grease both up and down the administrative ladder. Then there was the discount auto repair service that laid Warden Dunahy low. It went underground for a while and then emerged stronger than ever in the late '50s, and some of the contractors that worked at the prison from time to time were paying kickbacks to the top administration officials, I'm pretty sure. And the same was almost certainly true of the companies whose equipment was bought and installed in the laundry and the license plate shop and the stamping mill that was built in 1963. By the late '60s, there was also a booming trade in pills, and the same administrative crowd was involved in turning a buck on that. All of it added up to a pretty good-sized river of illicit income, not like the pile of clandestine bucks that must fly around a really big prison like Attica or San Quentin, but not peanuts either. And money itself becomes a problem after a while. You can't just stuff it into your wallet and then shell out a bunch of crumpled 20s and dog-eared 10s when you want a pool built in your backyard or an addition put on your house. Once you get past a certain point, you have to explain where that money came from. And if your explanations aren't convincing enough, you're apt to wind up wearing a number yourself. So there was a need for Andy's services. They took him out of the laundry and installed him in the library. but if you wanted to look at it another way, they never took him out of the laundry at all. They just set him to work washing dirty money instead of dirty sheets. He funneled it into stocks, bonds, tax-free municipals, you name it. He told me once, about 10 years after that day on the plate shop roof, that his feelings about what he was doing were pretty clear, and that his conscience was relatively untroubled. The rackets would have gone on with him or without him. He had not asked to be sent to Shawshank, he went on. He was an innocent man who had been victimized by colossal bad luck, not a missionary or a do-gooder. Besides, Red, he told me with that same half-grin, what I'm doing in here isn't all that different from what I was doing outside. I'll hand you a pretty cynical axiom. The amount of expert financial help an individual or company needs rises in direct proportion to how many people that person or business is screwing. The people who run this place are stupid, brutal monsters, for the most part. The people who run the straight world are brutal and monstrous, but they happen not to be quite as stupid, because the standard of competence out there is a little higher. Not much, but a little. But the pills, I said. I don't want to tell you your business, but they make me nervous. Reds, uppers, downers, nembutols. Now they've got these things they call phase fours. I won't get anything like that. Never have. No, Andy said. I don't like the pills either. Never have. But I'm not much of a one for cigarettes or booze either, but I don't push the pills. I don't bring them in, and I don't sell them once they are in. Mostly it's the screws who do that. But, yeah, I know there's a fine line there. What it comes down to, Red, is some people refuse to get their hands dirty at all. That's called sainthood, and the pigeons land on your shoulders and crap all over your shirt. The other extreme is to take a bath in the dirt and deal any goddamn thing that will turn a dollar. Guns, switchblades, Big H, what the hell. You ever have a con come up to you and offer you a contract? I nodded. It's happened a lot of times over the years. You are, after all, the man who can get it, and they figure if you can get them batteries for their transistor radios or cartons of Luckies or lids of reefer, you can put them in touch with a guy who'll use a knife. Sure you have, Andy agreed, but you don't do it. Because guys like us, Red, we know there's a third choice. An alternative to staying Simon pure or bathing in the filth and the slime. It's the alternative that grown-ups all over the world pick. You balance off your walk through the hog wallow against what it gains you. You choose the lesser of two evils and try to keep your good intentions in front of you. And I guess you judge how well you're doing by how well you sleep at night and what your dreams are like. Good intentions, I said, and laughed. I know all about that, Andy. A fella can toddle right off to hell on that road. Don't you believe it, he said, growing somber. This is hell. Right here in the shank. They sell pills, and I tell them what to do with the money. But I've also got the library, and I know of over 24 guys who have used the books in there to help them pass their high school equivalency tests. Maybe when they get out of here, they'll be able to crawl off the shit heap. When we needed that second room back in 1957, I got it, because they want to keep me happy. I work cheap. That's the trade-off. And you've got your own private quarters. Sure, that's the way I like it. The prison population had risen slowly all through the 50s, and it damn near exploded in the 60s, what with every college-age kid in America wanting to try dope and the perfectly ridiculous penalties for the use of a little reefer. But in all that time, Andy never had a cellmate, except for a big, silent Indian named Normadan. Like all the Indians in the shank, he was called Chief, and Normadan didn't last long. A lot of the other long-timers thought Andy was crazy, but Andy just smiled. He lived alone, and he liked it that way. And as he'd said, they liked to keep him happy. He worked cheap. Prison time is slow time. Sometimes you'd swear it's stop time, but it passes, it passes. George Donaghy departed the scene in a welter of newspaper headlines shouting scandal and nest-feathering. Stamos succeeded him, and for the next 6 years Shawshank was a kind of living hell. During the reign of Greg Stamos, the beds in the infirmary and the cells in the solitary wing were always full. One day in 1958, I looked at myself in a small shaving mirror I kept in my cell and saw a 40-year-old man looking back at me. A kid had come in back in 1938. A kid with a big mop of carroty red hair, half crazy with remorse, thinking about suicide. That kid was gone. The red hair was going gray and starting to recede. There were crow's tracks around the eyes. On that day, I could see an old man inside, waiting his time to come out. It scared me. Nobody wants to grow old in stir. Stamos went early in 1959. There had been several investigative reporters sniffing around, and one of them even did 4 months under an assumed name for a crime made up out of whole cloth. They were getting ready to drag out scandal and nest feathering again, but before they could bring the hammer down on him, Stamos ran. I can understand that, boy, can I ever. If he had been tried and convicted, he could have ended up right in here. If so, he might have lasted all of 5 hours. Byron Hadley had gone 2 years earlier. The sucker had a heart attack and took an early retirement. Andy never got touched by the Stamos affair. In early 1959, a new warden was appointed, and a new assistant warden, and a new chief of guards. For the next 8 months or so, Andy was just another con again. It was during that period that Normandin, the big half-breed Passamaquoddies, shared Andy's cell with him. Then everything just started up again. Normandin was moved out, and Andy was living in solitary splendor again. The names at the top change, but the rackets never do. I talked to Normandin once about Andy. Nice fella, Normandin said. Was hard to make out anything, he said, because he had a hare lip and a cleft palate. All his words came out in a slush. I liked it there. He never made fun. But he didn't want me there, I could tell. Big shrug. I was glad to go, me. Bad draft in that cell, all the time cold. He don't let nobody touch his things. That's okay, nice man, never made fun. But big draft. Rita Hayworth hung in Andy's cell until 1955, if I remember right. Then it was Marilyn Monroe. That picture from the 7-year itch, where she's standing over a subway grating and the warm air is flipping her skirt up. Marilyn lasted until 1960, and she was considerably tattered about the edges when Andy replaced her with Jane Mansfield. Jane was, you should pardon the expression, a bust. After only a year or so, she was replaced with an English actress. It might have been Hazel Court, but I'm not sure. In 1966, that one came down, and Raquel Welch went up for a record-breaking 6-year engagement in Andy's cell. The last poster to hang there was a pretty country rock singer whose name was Linda Ronstadt. I asked him once what the posters meant to him, and he gave me a peculiar, surprised sort of look. Why, they mean the same thing to me as they do to most cons, I guess, he said. Freedom. You look at those pretty women and you feel like you could almost, not quite, but almost, step right through and be beside them. Be free. I guess that's why I always liked Raquel Welch the best. It wasn't just her, it was that beach she was standing on. Looked like she was down in Mexico somewhere, someplace quiet where a man would be able to hear himself think. Did you ever feel that way about a picture, Red? That you could almost step right through it? I said I'd never really thought of it that way. Maybe someday you'll see what I mean, he said. And he was right. Years later, I saw exactly what he meant. And when I did, the first thing I thought of was Normandin, and about how he'd said it was always cold in Andy's cell. A terrible thing happened to Andy in late March or early April of 1963. I have told you that he had something that most of the other prisoners, myself included, seemed to lack. Call it a sense of equanimity, or a feeling of inner peace, maybe even a constant and unwavering faith that some day the long nightmare would end. Whatever you want to call it, Andy Dufresne always seemed to have his act together. There was none of that sullen desperation about him that seems to afflict most lifers after a while. You could never smell hopelessness on him. until that late winter of 63. We had another warden by then, a man named Samuel Norton. The Mathers, Cotton, and Increase would have felt right at home with Sam Norton. So far as I know, no one had ever seen him so much as crack a smile. He had a 30-year pin from the Baptist Advent Church of Elliott. His major innovation as the head of our happy family was to make sure that each incoming prisoner had a New Testament. He had a small plaque on his desk, gold letters inlaid in teak wood, which said, "Christ is my Savior." A sampler on the wall made by his wife read, "His judgment cometh, and that right early." This latter sentiment cut zero ice with most of us. We felt that the judgment had already occurred, and we would be willing to testify with the best of them that the rock would not hide us, nor the dead tree give us shelter. He had a Bible quote for every occasion, did Mr. Sam Norton. And whenever you meet a man like that, my best advice to you would be to grin big and cover up your balls with both hands. There were less infirmary cases than in the days of Greg Stamos, and so far as I know, the moonlight burials ceased altogether, but this is not to say that Norton was not a believer in punishment. Solitary was always well populated. Men lost their teeth not from beatings, but from bread and water diets. It began to be called grain and drain, as in, "I'm on the Sam Norton grain and drain train, boys." The man was the foulest hypocrite that I ever saw in high position. The rackets I told you about earlier continued to flourish, but Sam Norton added his own new wrinkles. And he knew about them all, and because we had gotten to be pretty good friends by that time, he let me in on some of them. When Andy talked about them, an expression of amused, disgusted wonder would come over his face, as if he were telling me about some ugly, predatory species of bug that was, by its very ugliness and greed, somehow more comic than terrible. It was Warden Norton who instituted the Inside Out program. You may have read about it some 16 or 17 years back. It was even written up in Newsweek. In the press, it sounded like a real advance in practical corrections and rehabilitation. There were prisoners out cutting pulpwood, prisoners repairing bridges and causeways, prisoners constructing potato cellars. Norton called it Inside Out, and was invited to explain it to damn near every Rotary and Kiwanis club in New England, especially after he got his picture in Newsweek. The prisoners called it road ganging. But so far as I know, none of them were ever invited to express their views to the Kiwanians or the Loyal Order of Moose. Norton was right in there, on every operation, 30-year church pin and all, from cutting pulp to digging storm drains to laying new culverts under state highways. There was Norton, skimming off the top. There were 100 ways to do it, men, materials, you name it. But he had it coming another way as well. The construction businesses in the area were deathly afraid of Norton's Inside-Out program because prison labor is slave labor, and you can't compete with that. So Sam Norton, he of the Testaments and the 30-year church pin, was passed a good many thick envelopes under the table during his 16-year tenure as Shawshank's warden, and when an envelope was passed, he would either overbid the project, not bid at all, or claim that all his inside-outers were committed elsewhere. It has always been something of a wonder to me that Norton was never found in the trunk of a Thunderbird parked off a highway somewhere down in Massachusetts, with his hands tied behind his back and half a dozen bullets in his head. Anyway, as the old Barrel House song says, "My God, how the money rolled in." Norton must have subscribed to the old Puritan notion that the best way to figure out which folks God favors is by checking their bank accounts. Andy Dufresne was his right hand in all of this, his silent partner. The prison library was Andy's hostage to fortune. Norton knew it, and Norton used it. Andy told me that one of Norton's favorite aphorisms was, "One hand washes the other." So Andy gave good advice and made useful suggestions. I can't say for sure that he hand-tooled Norton's Inside-Out program, but I'm damn sure he processed the money for the Jesus-shouting son of a whore. He gave good advice, made useful suggestions. The money got spread around, and son of a bitch, the library would get a new set of automotive repair manuals, a fresh set of Grolier encyclopedias, books on how to prepare for the scholastic achievement tests, and, of course, more Earl Stanley Gardners and more Louis L'Amours. And I'm convinced that what happened happened because Norton just didn't want to lose his good right hand. I'll go further. It happened because he was scared of what might happen, what Andy might say against him if Andy ever got clear of Shawshank State Prison. I got the story a chunk here and a chunk there over a space of 7 years, some of it from Andy, but not all. He never wanted to talk about that part of his life, and I don't blame him. I got parts of it from maybe half a dozen different sources. I've said once that prisoners are nothing but slaves, but they have that slave habit of looking dumb and keeping their ears open. I got it backwards and forwards and in the middle, but I'll give it to you from point A to point Z, and maybe you'll understand why the man spent about 10 months in a bleak, depressed daze. See, I don't think he knew the truth until 1963, 15 years after he came into this sweet little hellhole. Until he met Tommy Williams, I don't think he knew how bad it could get. Tommy Williams joined our happy little Shawshank family in November of 1962. Tommy thought of himself as a native of Massachusetts, but he wasn't proud. In his 27 years he'd done time all over New England. He was a professional thief, and as you may have guessed, my own feeling was that he should have picked another profession. He was a married man, and his wife came to visit each and every week. She had an idea that things might go better with Tommy, and consequently better with their 3-year-old son and herself, if he got his high school degree. She talked him into it, and so Tommy Williams started visiting the library on a regular basis. For Andy, this was an old routine by then. He saw that Tommy got a series of high school equivalency tests. Tommy would brush up on the subjects he had passed in high school, there weren't many, and then take the test. Andy also saw that he was enrolled in a number of correspondence courses covering the subjects he had failed in school or just missed by dropping out. He probably wasn't the best student Andy ever took over the jumps, and I don't know if he ever did get his high school diploma, but that forms no part of my story. The important thing was that he came to like Andy Dufresne very much, as most people did after a while. On a couple of occasions he asked Andy what a smart guy like you is doing in the joint, a question which is the rough equivalent of one that goes, "What's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this?" But Andy wasn't the type to tell him. He would only smile and turn the conversation into some other channel. Quite normally, Tommy asked someone else, and when he finally got the story, I guess he also got the shock of his young life. The person he asked was his partner on the laundry's steam ironer and folder. The inmates call this device the mangler because that's exactly what it'll do to you if you aren't paying attention and get your bad self caught in it. His partner was Charlie Lathrop, who had been in for about 12 years on a murder charge. He was more than glad to reheat the details of the Dufresne murder trial for Tommy. It broke the monotony of pulling freshly pressed bedsheets out of the machine and tucking them into the basket. He was just getting to the jury, waiting until after lunch to bring in their guilty verdict, when the trouble whistle went off and the mangle grated to a stop. They had been feeding in freshly washed sheets from the Elliott nursing home at the far end. These were spat out dry and neatly pressed at Tommy's and Charlie's end at the rate of 1 every 5 seconds. Their job was to grab them, fold them, and slap them into the cart, which had already been lined with clean brown paper. But Tommy Williams was just standing there, staring at Charlie Lathrop, his mouth unhinged all the way to his chest. He was standing in a drift of sheets that had come through clean and which were now sopping up all the wet muck on the floor. And in a laundry wet wash, there's plenty of muck. So the head bull that day, Homer Jessup, comes rushing over, bellowing his head off and on the prod for trouble. Tommy took no notice of him. He spoke to Charlie as if old Homer, who had busted more heads than he could probably count, hadn't been there. "What did you say that golf pro's name was?" "Quentin," Charlie answered back, all confused and upset by now. He later said that the kid was white as a truce flag. "Glenn Quentin, I think, something like that anyway." Here now," Homer Jessup roared, his neck as red as a rooster's comb. "Get them sheets in cold water. Get quick, by Jesus, you—" "Glenn Quentin. Oh, my God," Tommy Williams said, and that was all he got to say because Homer Jessup, that least peaceable of men, brought his billy down behind his ear. Tommy hit the floor so hard he broke off three of his front teeth. When he woke up, he was in solitary and confined to same for a week, riding a boxcar on Sam Norton's famous grain and drain train, plus a black mark on his report card. That was in early February of 1963, and Tommy Williams went around to six or seven other long-timers after he got out of solitary and got pretty much the same story. I know I was one of them. But when I asked him why he wanted it, he just clammed up. Then one day he went to the library and spilled one hell of a big budget of information to Andy Dufresne. And for the first and last time, at least since he had approached me about the Rita Hayworth poster like a kid buying his first pack of Trojans, Andy lost his cool. Only this time, he blew it entirely. I saw him later that day, and he looked like a man who had stepped on the business end of a rake and given himself a good one, whap, between the eyes. His hands were trembling, and when I spoke to him, he didn't answer. Before that afternoon was out, he had caught up with Billy Hanlon, who was the head screw, and set up an appointment with Warden Norton for the following day. He told me later that he didn't sleep a wink all that night. He just listened to a cold winter wind howling outside, watched the searchlights go around and around, putting long, moving shadows on the cement walls of the cage he had called home since Harry Truman was president, and tried to think it all out. He said it was as if Tommy had produced a key which fit a cage in the back of his mind, a cage like his own cell. Only instead of holding a man, that cage held a tiger, and that tiger's name was Hope. Williams had produced the key that unlocked the cage, and the tiger was out, willy-nilly, to roam his brain. 4 years before, Tommy Williams had been arrested in Rhode Island, driving a stolen car that was full of stolen merchandise. Tommy turned in his accomplice, the DA played ball, and he got a lighter sentence, 2 to 4 with time served. 11 months after beginning his term, his old cellmate got a ticket out, and Tommy got a new one, a man named Elwood Blatch. Blatch had been busted for burglary with a weapon and was serving 6 to 12. "I've never seen such a high-strung guy," Tommy told me. "A man like that should never want to be a burglar, especially not with a gun. The slightest little noise he'd go 3 feet into the air and come down shooting, more likely than not. One night he almost strangled me because some guy down the hall was whopping on his cell bars with a tin cup. I did 7 months with him until they let me walk free. I got time served and time off, you understand. I can't say we talked because you didn't, you know, exactly hold a conversation with L. Blatch. He held a conversation with you. He talked all the time, never shut up. If you tried to get a word in, he'd shake his fist at you and roll his eyes. It gave me the cold chills whenever he done that. Big, tall guy he was, mostly bald, with these green eyes set way down deep in the sockets. Jeez, I hope I never see him again. It was like a talking jag every night. Where he grew up, the orphanages he'd run away from, the jobs he'd done, the women he'd fucked, the crap games he'd cleaned out. I just let him run on. My face ain't much, but I didn't want it, you know, rearranged for me. According to him, he'd burgled over 200 joints. It was hard for me to believe a guy like him who went off like a firecracker every time someone cut a loud fart, but he swore it was true. Now, listen to me, Red, I know guys sometimes make things up after they know a thing, but even before I knew about this golf pro guy, Quentin, I remember thinking that if L. Blatch ever burgled my house and I found out about it later, I'd have to count myself just about the luckiest motherfucker going still to be alive. Can you imagine him in some lady's bedroom sifting through her jewelry box and she coughs in her sleep or turns over quick? Gives me the cold chills just to think of something like that. I swear on my mother's name it does. He said he'd killed people, too. People that gave him shit. At least that's what he said. And I believed him. He sure looked like a man who could do some killing. He was just so fucking high-strung. Like a pistol with a sawed-off firing pin. I knew a guy who had a Smith & Wesson police special with a sawed-off firing pin. It wasn't no good for nothing, except maybe for something to jaw about. The pull on that gun was so light that it would fire if this guy, Johnny Callahan his name was, if he turned his record player on full volume and put it on top of one of the speakers. That's how L. Blatch was. I can't explain it any better. I just never doubted that he had greased some people. So one night, just for something to say, I go, "Who'd you kill?" Like a joke, you know, so he laughs and says, "There's one guy doing time up Maine for these two people I killed. It was this guy and the wife of the slob was doing the time. I was creeping their place and the guy started to give me some shit." I can't remember if he ever told me the woman's name or not, Tommy went on. Maybe he did. But in New England, Dufresne's like Smith or Jones in the rest of the country, because there's so many frogs up here. Dufresne, Levesque, Ouellette, Poulin, who can remember frog names? But he told me the guy's name. He said the guy was Glenn Quentin, and he was a prick, a big, rich prick, a golf pro. Al said he thought the guy might have cash in the house, maybe as much as $5,000. That was a lot of money back then, he says to me, so I go, "When was that?" And he goes, "After the war, just after the war." So he went in and he did the joint, and they woke up and the guy gave him some trouble. That's what Els said. Maybe the guy just started to snore, that's what I say. Anyway, Els said Quentin was in the sack with some hotshot lawyer's wife, and they sent the lawyer up to Shawshank State Prison. Then he laughs this big laugh. Holy Christ, I was never so glad of anything as I was when I got my walking papers from that place. I guess you can see why Andy went a little wonky when Tommy told him that story, and why he wanted to see the warden right away. Elwood Blatch had been serving a 6-to-12 rap when Tommy knew him 4 years before. By the time Andy heard all of this in 1963, he might be on the verge of getting out, or already out. So those were the two prongs of the spit Andy was roasting on. The idea that Blatch might still be in, on one hand, and the very real possibility that he might be gone like the wind, on the other. There were inconsistencies in Tommy's story, but aren't there always in real life? Blatch told Tommy the man who got sent up was a hotshot lawyer, and Andy was a banker. But those are two professions that people who aren't very educated could easily get mixed up. And don't forget that 12 years had gone by between the time Blatch was reading the clippings about the trial and the time he told the tale to Tommy Williams. He also told Tommy he got better than $1,000 from a footlocker Quentin had in his closet, but the police said at Andy's trial that there had been no sign of burglary. I have a few ideas about that. First, if you take the cash and the man it belonged to is dead, how are you going to know anything was stolen, unless someone else can tell you it was there to start with? Second, who's to say Blatch wasn't lying about that part of it? Maybe he didn't want to admit killing two people for nothing. Third, maybe there were signs of burglary and the cops either overlooked them, cops can be pretty dumb, or deliberately covered them up so they wouldn't screw the DA's case. The guy was running for public office, remember, and he needed a conviction to run on. An unsolved burglary murder would have done him no good at all. But of the three, I like the middle one best. I've known a few Elwood Blatches in my time at Shawshank, the trigger pullers with the crazy eyes. Such fellows want you to think they got away with the equivalent of the Hope Diamond on every caper, even if they got caught with a $2 Timex and $9 on the one they're doing time for. And there was one thing in Tommy's story that convinced Andy beyond a shadow of a doubt. Blatch hadn't hit Quentin at random. He had called Quentin a big, rich prick, and he had known Quentin was a golf pro. Well, Andy and his wife had been going out to that country club for drinks and dinner once or twice a week for a couple of years, and Andy had done a considerable amount of drinking there once he found out about his wife's affair. There was a marina with the country club, and for a while in 1947 there had been a part-time grease and gas jockey working there who matched Tommy's description of Elwood Blatch. A big, tall man, mostly bald, with deep-set green eyes. A man who had an unpleasant way of looking at you, as though he was sizing you up. He wasn't there long, Andy said. Either he quit, or Briggs, the fellow in charge of the marina, fired him. But he wasn't a man you forgot. He was too striking for that. So Andy went to see Warden Norton on a rainy, windy day, with big gray clouds scudding across the sky above the gray walls, a day when the last of the snow was starting to melt away and show lifeless patches of last year's grass in the fields beyond the prison. The warden has a good-sized office in the administration wing, and behind the warden's desk there's a door which connects with the assistant warden's office. The assistant warden was out that day, but a trustee was there. He was a half-lame fellow whose real name I have forgotten. All the inmates, me included, called him Chester, after Marshal Dillon's sidekick. Chester was supposed to be watering the plants and waxing the floor. My guess is that the plants went thirsty that day, and the only waxing that was done happened because of Chester's dirty ear polishing the keyhole plate of that connecting door. He heard the warden's main door open and close, and then Norton saying, "Good morning, Dufresne. How can I help you?" "Warden," Andy began, and old Chester told us that he could hardly recognize Andy's voice, it was so changed. "Warden, there's something's happened to me that's so I hardly know where to begin." "Well, why don't you just begin at the beginning?" the warden said, probably in his sweetest let's all turn to the 23rd psalm and read in unison voice. That usually works the best. And so Andy did. He began by refreshing Norton on the details of the crime he had been imprisoned for. Then he told the warden exactly what Tommy Williams had told him. He also gave out Tommy's name, which you may think wasn't so wise in light of later developments, but I'd just ask you what else he could have done if his story was to have any credibility at all. When he had finished, Norton was completely silent for some time. I can just see him, probably tipped back in his office chair under the picture of Governor Reed hanging on the wall, his fingers steepled, his liver lips pursed, his brow wrinkled into ladder rungs halfway to the crown of his head, his 30-year pin gleaming mellowly. "Yes," he said finally, "that's the damnedest story I ever heard. But I'll tell you what surprises me most about it, Dufresne." "What's that, sir?" "That you were taken in by it." "Sir, I don't understand what you mean." And Chester said that Andy Dufresne, who had faced down Byron Hadley on the plate shop roof 13 years before, was almost floundering for words. "Well now," Norton said, "it's pretty obvious to me that this young fellow Williams is impressed with you. Quite taken with you, as a matter of fact. He hears your tale of woe, and it's quite natural of him to want to cheer you up, let's say. Quite natural, as a young man, not terribly bright, not surprising he didn't realize what a state it would put you into. Now, what I suggest is..." "Don't you think I thought of that?" Andy asked. "But I never told Tommy about the man working down at the marina. I never told anyone that. It never even crossed my mind. But Tommy's description of his cellmate and that man, they're identical." "Well, now, you may be indulging in a little selective perception there," Norton said with a chuckle. Phrases like that, selective perception, are required learning for people in the penology and corrections business, and they use them all they can. "That's not it at all, sir." "That's your slant on it," Norton said. "But mine differs. And let's remember that I have only your word that there was such a man working at the Falmouth Hills Country Club back then." "No, sir," Andy broke in again. "No, that isn't true, because..." "Anyway," Norton overrode him, expansive and loud, "let's just look at it from the other end of the telescope, shall we? Suppose now, that there really was a fellow named Elwood Blotch." "Blatch," Andy said tightly. "Blatch, by all means. And let's say he was Thomas Williams' cellmate in Rhode Island. The chances are excellent that he has been released by now. Excellent. Why, we don't even know how much time he might have done there before he ended up with Williams, do we? Only that he was doing a 6 to 12. "No, we don't know how much time he'd done. But Tommy said he was a bad actor, a cut-up. I think there's a fair chance that he may still be in. Even if he's been released, the prison will have a record of his last known address, the names of his relatives, and both would almost certainly be dead ends." Andy was silent for a moment, and then he burst out, "Well, it's a chance, isn't it?" "Yes, of course it is. So just for the moment, Dufresne, let's assume that Blatch exists, and that he is still safely ensconced in the Rhode Island State Penitentiary. Now, what is he going to say if we bring this kettle of fish to him in a bucket? Is he going to fall down on his knees, roll his eyes, and say, 'I did it, I did it, by all means add a life term onto my charge'?